My children, who are 8 and 10, are old enough now to realize when I'm listening to the news on the car radio. More importantly, they're starting to listen along, starting to realize that these random disembodied voices might actually be connected to reality, reality that might actually have something to do with their lives. I have limits to what I'll let them overhear, but these are not nearly as strict as what I'll let them see in the visual version of the news. As I tell them often, while you might be able to forget a few words or the overheard description of something terrible, it is so much harder to unsee. Still, their listening on the radio is not an unambiguous good or a clear-cut parenting choice. Our drive to and from school or day camp, particularly in these last couple of months, have brought up many uncomfortable, impossible-to-explain topics, with questions I'm not sure I want to be answering, that I'm not sure I have the tools to answer, and things that I want to protect them from knowing. And yet, at the same time, this past week, for example, our car radio listening led to serious and complex conversations about race and racism, policing and politics, about language and bullying, sexism and immigration, and even about the ways that minority groups are often pitted against each other as a strategy to perpetuate the status quo of white supremacy, patriarchy, and unrestrained free market capitalism. I might have used some different words in speaking to my 8 and 10-year-old. A couple of weeks ago, we listened together to the basic report of a white police officer shooting Philando Castile, an African-American man, in his car with a child in the back seat. I hit the off button on the radio right before it played that recording from his girlfriend, the eerie calm of a woman in the full throes of crisis being comforted by her child. That was my line. Maybe you will think I should have turned it off before, that my kids were too young to even know that much. One morning last week, as I turned on the radio to begin our drive, I sighed heavily as I readied myself for the latest. Gracie looked at me as I did and asked, "What, Mom? Has someone been shot again?" It hit me then just what it meant to let her know this as reality, as normal. So maybe you would be right. Maybe I should protect them as long as I can, because it is too much for any of us, including us grown-ups. And yet still, this is the reality of today. As Unitarian Universalist Rebecca Parker writes, we are living in a post-slavery, post-Holocaust, post-Vietnam, post-Hiroshima world. We are living in the aftermath of collective generational violence that has been severe, massive, traumatic. We are living in the midst of rainforest burning, the rapid death of species, the growing pollution of the air and water, and the new mutations of racism and violence. Our bodies carry these stories. It is in the air we breathe, in our social systems and our institutions, even if we don't always realize it, even if we turn off the radio, even if we choose to turn away, even if we have the privilege not to tell our children. I think it would be reasonable, in response to this reality, to decide nothing matters. Just to choose not to care, to simply respond to all this pain and decide that your life, that life itself, really has no meaning. I mean, you might be familiar with Albert Camus' retelling of the myth of Sisyphus. You know, Sisyphus, who was condemned to repeat forever that same meaningless task of pushing a boulder up a mountain, only to see it rolled back down again and again. This, Camus, is the essence of human existence. Pushing the boulder up the hill, only to watch it roll down again. Repeat, repeat, And to make matters worse, in spite of life's apparent meaninglessness and indifference to human existence, Camus observes, humans still keep searching for meaning. This is what he and we call absurdity. Now, absurdist and nihilistic notions of life's utter meaninglessness is the fuel for midlife crises and what some call the young adult failure to launch that brings 20-somethings back to their parents' basements. It enables Netflix binges and political apathy. It seems to be intimately connected to the force that keeps you stuck on your couch watching cat videos. And some of us find it staring back at us from the bottom of a gin bottle. Surely this loss of meaning is at the heart of depression, acute, chronic, clinical, or otherwise. That might hit us at any age or stage of life, and hit is the operative word. For depression like this knocks you over, knocks the wind out of you. Life loses its movement, its generativity. It's one of the reasons that depression is such a difficult disease and requires almost always therapeutic intervention, counseling, or medication in order to heal or transform. For once meaninglessness takes hold, it is self-perpetuating and immobilizing, full stop. But this immobile, full stop, we know this is not life. Life is not static. It is dynamic, evolving, always unfolding. In life, there is always the in and out of breath. So much is always going on, always being created. Always more than one story is true, and the stories are always changing. Remember the farmer and our ideas about truth a few weeks ago. Life is, we'll see. I was listening to an NPR program about improv this past week, and it reminded me that most important rule of improv, which goes, yes, and. The idea being that you're in a scene and you don't get to decline the reality of the scene that your partners have just given you. You have to accept it and then add to it. It's not yes, but, or no, and. It's yes, and. This, I thought then, was another good way to think about truth, accepting reality as it is being offered and yet also knowing the scene is not done yet. We get to be a part of the next new creation. Yes. And because life is not just about loss, it is also about continuous creativity. In addition to all those things, I started the sermon with, life is also about summer berries and mountain hikes, red rocks and the moon hanging there big and bold through the clouds. It is about waking up beside the one you love. It is pleasure and it is discovery and it is silliness. It is both the reality of the children who stayed in our church this week because they don't have homes, and it is the sound of those same children playing and laughing in the front grass with my daughter while I'm inside for a board meeting. As Parker also says about life today, there are also arenas of great vitality and freshness. Music and the arts are flourishing. New movements in religion and spirituality are blossoming. Computer technology advancing at breathtaking speed and often characterized by a spirit of whimsy is creating new patterns of human connection and manifesting new partnerships in justice. Cross-cultural encounters and countercultural movements are opening up new possibilities in social change, medicine, business, religion, and the arts. Life is resilient, and through it all, there remains great goodness, kindness, beauty, and joy. Living in these times, Parker says, I feel the simultaneous presence of violence, chaos, loss, creativity, liberation, possibility, recovery, connection, and empowerment. All of these are the realities of life today and life as a whole. Despite the short memories and attention span of our culture, the need for breaking news where everything must seem urgently new and novel, in many ways, the moment we are in is just life being lifelike. Which means we need a way of understanding the meaning of life that holds this whole, a story of meaning and purpose that allows our hands and our hearts to open to the fullness of reality, both the trauma and the vitality, the cruelty and the courage, the breakdowns and the possibility, and the ways that life and truth are always beginning again and again. So as a part of preparing for today, I read the book that a few of you are reading as a part of our book group called The Meaning of Human Existence. It's by a biologist, Edward O. Wilson. I chose the topic today long before I knew that the group would choose the book, but it was such a happy coincidence that I figured I should go ahead and learn about his perspective. Wilson takes the story of evolution, the story of the universe, what we know scientifically, and offers it as the answer to the meaning of life. He describes the meaning of human existence in terms of having evolved over ages, passing into recorded history, and, quote, urgently now, day by day, faster and faster into the indefinite future, it is also what we will choose to become. By which he means, while there may have been, he kind of lands on the pretty confident, there may not have been pre-existing meaning to human existence. And even though, from what we can tell, human life is an accident, now that we have arrived, life does have meaning, and increasingly so. It has meaning in the choices we make, the ways we will enable life to continue and to flourish or not. Life, he says, needs our participation. The earth needs our stewardship, and how we act does matter. This enabling of life or failing to do so, according to Wilson, is the meaning of life. Further, this capacity to act corresponds with our capacity to engage with a biological imperative for what he calls the human tension. This is that tension that often we'll hear in other terms in religious settings, something, a tension of good and evil, or sin and righteousness. He describes it as a human tension between our inherent selfishness and our equally inherent altruism and kindness towards others. He says both are true and in their own way both have evolutionary advantages. Wilson's approach is quite new, based on very current theories of evolutionary biology, but his conclusions actually struck me as old, even ancient. For example, in ancient Greece, Aristotle spoke of life's purpose as a matter of learning about virtue, i.e., the struggling with that human tension between selfishness and altruism, and then trying to live a virtuous life so that our individual lives can contribute to the common highest good, i.e., enabling life. The ancient Greeks called this highest good, which is what they understood as the meaning of life, they called it eudaimonia. Some have translated eudaimonia to mean happiness, but a better translation is human flourishing. This mistranslation has likely helped to support the idea that the meaning of life is to be individually happy. This sense of life's meaning seems problematic, however, if we are to take in the whole of reality that I described earlier. Individual happiness, however, was never what the Greeks were after. Human flourishing was meant to describe the advancement, the continued and ever-increasing abundance of that great big whole. Or, as author Annie Dillard has put it, our purpose in life is to aid and abet creation and to witness it, to notice each thing so that each thing gets noticed. I've heard that phrase quite a few times. There was something this time that I really got that wonderful combination of aid and abet. It's usually used in a negative term, right? It calls to mind some of the human tensions that Wilson was talking about. But we are here to aid and abet creation, to witness it. We are here to keep alive and grow the human imagination for life, the sense of abundant possibilities, that moral imagination, which means we are here to keep making something beautiful wherever we find ourselves, to keep believing that something new is still beginning, to keep scattering seeds again and again, and still to keep bearing witness to the whole. Now, so far, I've focused this sermon on the meaning of life, but the original impulse for this not small topic came when one of you asked me about death. You wanted me to explain the Unitarian Universalist understanding of what happens when we die. You said, "I know we don't really know, but tell me anyway." I mean, even this isn't quite right, because although these are the words you said, underneath these words that seemed like they were asking for information or facts, we both understood there was actually just grief, your heartbreak and longing. You hoped our faith, your beloved faith, could offer a promise, an assurance, because the one you loved died, is dying, will die. "What does our faith have to offer me for this?" you asked. "What meanings, tools, and just plain comfort does our faith provide?" I nodded back at you. "Yes," I said. "I hear you." This is what I was talking about last week when I quoted that poet Stephen Dunn when he came to acknowledge that evolution is magical, but you can't say to your child, "Evolution loves you." Which is to say that the meaning of life or death doesn't matter all that much if it can't meet you here in this longing and this grief, if it can't comfort you. Meaning, if it is to be meaningful, needs to have skin on it. So when you said all this to me about death, I thought to myself, I need to preach about life, the meaning of life. I know it doesn't seem like the answer you were looking for, but the two do go together, especially in our faith. In our faith, we say death matters and means something because there was a life that mattered and had meaning. And life would be so much less if it wasn't so fragile and vulnerable. All these calls for safety and reassurance of absolute safety, it's like they don't know that life is about risk. And that life is meaningful because it is risky, because there is this built-in ending, that there is no guarantee. Death gives life meaning. Now, you're right, I can't tell you what happens when we die. But I can assure you that death definitely does not mark the end of meaning. Often, instead, it reveals the meaning of life in a way that we never before understood. New insights that keep arriving, new perspectives, sometimes actual new information. I can't tell you how many memorials I've done where I sit there with the family and they go, "I never knew." Even after death, truth continues to be revealed, and love continues to live and grow and evolve. Kate Braestrup, a UU minister and chaplain for the game wardens in Maine, she tells about the terrible moments of having to knock on someone's door and tell them their loved one has died. She says in these moments, she feels the clearest presence of the holy. She says, in the wailing scream of the loved one's loss, in their denial, in their anger, in their throwing up, in all the many ways we react when someone we loved has died, this is the holy. Because they reveal that these lives mattered, that they had meaning, and that they will keep having meaning. Hell, she says, is when you die and no one cares. Now, our universalist faith calls us then, even in death, to a life that bears witness, that remembers and pays attention. This is not too far from the ideas of God that Elie Wiesel came to in response to the Holocaust. He said, God is simply that which remembers. We are living in a complex time, a sometimes chaotic feeling time, a time of unrest and anxiety. And yet we are also living in a time of great peace, health, generosity, discovery, and prosperity, a time of both loss and new birth, a time that is both uncharted territory as well as just the latest version of life as it has been going on throughout time. We, inheritors of all of this, we cannot afford to pick up just one part of life to respond to or pay attention to, or to make meaning out of a partial view. We cannot waste our time with ideas that sound good, but that don't actually bring us or anyone comfort when grief arrives, as it will, and too soon. The meaning we make of life needs to be the result of having lived, of having made life our whole occupation, of risking love, even though there is no guarantee, in spite of the world's sometimes indifference, with the bravery of simply choosing to love, choosing to live as if our life matters, as if every life matters, as if life itself is in our hands. Together, we take this great leap of faith, bearing witness to it all and giving thanks. Amen, and blessed be.